Thank you, Martin, and thanks everyone for coming. That's precisely what I want to talk about, the basic point that although we like to think of ourselves as well-suited for the environments we live in, that is, we're well-adapted for the places we live and the way in which we live, many of the traits that we have or that we express, particularly in males, are traits that are actually detrimental to us. But they persist and evolve because they benefit us in mating. Now, when I say us, I mean very generally animals. So most of my talk will not be about humans or anything like that, but I want to try and outline some general concepts and principles and then talk about how they apply in several natural systems, focus in some detail on one natural system that I've been working on since I came to McGill, actually a little bit from before that. And then what I want to do is at the very end, I want to return to some of those questions that I talked about with respect to other organisms and then ask what might be the analogies from humans. So the title of my talk is Natural and Sexual Selection Fistfight in Nature. And indeed, this fistfight idea is the general feeling that natural and sexual selection should be favoring different things. And I'll explain what natural and sexual selection are. And there's the guppy there, some representatives from some of our field work. So in essence, what we're trying to explain is how you get a diversity of life. So you take here, for example, the radiation of Hawaiian honeycreepers. So some ancestral honeycreeper, represented by this unknown gray individual, colonized the Hawaiian Islands several million years ago, and in the time since, diverged into a whole host of different types of honeycreepers, specializing on different food types. So this is an adaptive radiation. As adaptation to different environments was driven by natural selection and led to this great diversity of life. Now, the way in which this works, of course, is natural selection. And so I'll give you a little bit of an introduction to natural selection, where it came from, and how it works. But it is really the primary driver of adaptation and therefore evolutionary diversification and all of the diversity of life you see around us. This insight, of course, comes from Charles Darwin over here and Alfred Russel Wallace, the co-discoverers of natural selection. And this principle was laid out most clearly, of course, in Darwin's Origin of Species, where he also outlined the evidence for evolution in general. But the real unique part of that book was to explain why evolution works, and that is through natural selection. Now, the way in which natural selection works is quite simple to understand because it has only several assumptions, and if those assumptions are true, then evolution by natural selection must occur. So let's take a look at them. So these are both Darwin and Wallace independently came up with these ideas and published them at almost exactly the same time. As a matter of fact, before The Origin of Species, they published a pair of joint papers in the Philosophical Transactions of the Royal Society, and that was the introduction of natural selection to the rest of the world. So here's how it works. These are some assumptions that I think we'll agree that are all true, and if they're all true, then the outcome will necessarily be evolution by natural selection. The first point is that all organisms have the potential for exponential population growth, but that is not realized. So even Darwin had a nice explanation of if you took elephants and you just let them breed and at their normal reproductive rate, none of the offspring died, that is, they all survived to reproduce, and then they died. Now, after they were no longer reproductive. Now, in that situation, it would take only tens of thousands of years before all of Africa was completely shoulder to shoulder with elephants. And yet it's not, of course. So that means that there's a very high mortality rate in nature. Most organisms die before they reproduce or die before they can reproduce at their maximum. So if there's a lot of mortality going on, perhaps the traits of organisms matter for their probability of survival. So the next idea then is the obvious observation that traits vary among individuals in all organisms. Humans, you look around the room, we all look different from each other. That's true of all animals. Individuals differ from each other in pretty much anything you can measure, physiology, morphology, behavior, a whole host of traits. And perhaps those traits matter for survival. So there's a lot of death going on, but maybe the individuals that are surviving through that death period are the individuals that have particular traits They might be taller. They might be faster. Things like that. That makes sense as well. We can obviously see how the traits of individuals will influence their performance and therefore their survival. And the final step is that if those traits are heritable, that is passed on from parents to offspring, then you will necessarily see a shift to the next generation towards more traits that are well suited for high survival. So those are the assumptions, and that is the result then, that traits that improve survival should evolve. Lots of death, but the traits of individuals matter for who lives and who dies. Those traits are then passed on to the kids, so the next generation has traits that are better suited than the previous. That's the process of evolution by natural selection. So my lab generally explores these problems and others in natural populations. So our main emphasis is in trying to understand how natural selection works and drives diversification by focusing in on particular model organisms, including salmon. We did some work on sharks, stickleback fishes, guppies, which I'm going to focus on for part of my talk, and Darwin's finches from the Galapagos Islands. So here's what I want to do then with the rest of the talk. The first thing is I want to give a more detailed explanation, not just of natural selection per se, but of how natural selection creates differences among populations in different environments. So I started off with the idea that you have these honey creepers are each adapted to do different things, feed on different things, and within each one of those, natural selection has driven those traits. So that means that natural selection was pushing populations apart until they became separate species. So I want to focus on how that works. Then I want to talk about the whole wrench in the engine, if you will. And that is that many of the traits that are responding to the environment are also traits that are subject to strange nuances of sexual selection, which is improving mating success, not survival. So this compromise between trying to maximize mating versus trying to maximize survival leads to constraints on what organisms can achieve in response to natural selection. I'll give a detailed explanation of that in Trinidadian guppies and then try and draw some analogies to the same sorts of questions I've asked about, but in a particular human trait. Okay. So let me give you just a basic background now, not just on how selection causes change within a population, but how it pushes populations apart and brings them to different places. So you can start with the idea that you have two different environments. So for honey creepers, they could be different food types. Or they could be any other environmental contrast. And let's just say, for instance, that one environment favors small size and another environment favors large size. And this is what I'll return to when I talk about humans. Now, you can imagine there's two populations of some species in those two environments, and we would therefore expect that you'd have small size evolving here and large size evolving there. So here's what it looks like, thinking about it a little more formally. You have some relationship between size and survival, and in this population, the highest survival will be achieved at a smaller body size than in this population. So selection pushes them apart. And indeed, then, the outcome is in this population, you have the traits, body size, should be here, and in this population, should be there. So you have the distribution, the frequency of body sizes are different between the two populations because selection has pushed them apart. So I want to give you an example, a concrete example from real natural organisms, referring to some work that I did mostly for my PhD, but continued to some extent after I came to McGill. And that is the interaction between bears and salmon in Alaska. So I'm trying to give you a real concrete example of how this process works. So I'll give you a little background on salmon first. Salmon spend most of their lives out in the ocean, where they do most of their growing. Then when it's time to breed, they all return into fresh water. And sockeye salmon, which is what I'm focusing on, spend their time hanging out in lakes while they're finished maturation, and then they enter into small creeks or other environments, and that's going to be my point, to breed. And so here's a female and a male sockeye salmon that are breeding in one particular location in Alaska. And then, after a couple of weeks of breeding, they all die. So they're what's called semoparous. That is, they breed once and then it's all over. Big bang reproduction. Now, in this situation, there's very strong selection acting on them to not only survive this period, but to obtain mates. And I alluded to the fact that small creeks versus other environments could be important. And that's what's shaping the evolution of body size and shape in these fish. And that's because different water depths have differential susceptibility to predation by bears. So in deep water, bears can't get at the salmon. So any salmon they do get were already dead, or they just sort of happen to get them at random. However, in very small creeks like this one here, the bears basically have their pick of the fish. They can just walk in and grab the fish. So this creek here, it's only 2 kilometers long, and 17,000 salmon spawned in that creek in the span of about 2 weeks. And you can see that they're sticking, their backs are sticking out of the water. That's as they're breeding. So the bears walk around and they pick fish, and they pick the bigger ones. First, because they're easier to catch, and second, because they have more energy to them. So that means that you're always selecting against large fish here and deep-bodied fish, but not here. So let's take a look at some data then. Here are data for a whole bunch of different salmon populations where you have the size of the stream along this axis and the amount of predation by bears acting on the population on the other axis. So you see you have some populations where you have massive mortality rates of bears killing salmon, and other streams where mortality rates or locations where it's very low. So what happens to evolution? Well, we'd expect these guys to evolve to be smaller because bears are always taking the bigger ones, but these guys not so much so. So let's take a look at that. Here are representative examples of salmon from these different populations. And you can see that the most striking thing about these males is that they differ dramatically in how deep their body is. So these guys, from sites where mortality rates are very low because the streams are very big, have very deep bodies. These guys, however, from streams where mortality rates are very high because they're small streams, they have much shallower bodies. So that's representation. Here are the actual data here. And what you see is for each of a whole bunch of populations, you see the size, how deep the body is over here in relation to the size of the stream using a different scaling. And you can see that as stream size goes up, you get deeper-bodied males and, to some extent, deeper-bodied females. So this means that you have dramatic adaptive divergence between small streams and large streams in a trait. Small size was selected in small streams, large sizes in large streams, so they diverged correspondingly. So that's great, everything's well, but why are they deep-bodied in the first place? What's the value of having a deep body? Moreover, if you look at and think about that question, you see that males have much deeper bodies than do females. So this is suggesting that there's something in particular about being a male that favors having this deep body. And that deep body is overall bad in these streams. So what is that other thing? Well, we have many examples of the same sort of thing. These are just a selection of images from Google showing the crazy things that males do and the traits that they express that would seem to provide no benefit to survival. As a matter of fact, they would seem to be a real detriment to survival. So you have these crazy colors and the peacock's tail, as Martin introduced. You have frogs calling, and then they get grabbed by bats or owls. I watched, this is cool, in Mont Saint-Hilaire, I watched an owl sitting beside a pond. It's a tiny pond on the top of Mont Saint-Hilaire. And I was like, what is the owl doing there? And I was taking pictures of it and everything. And all of a sudden, the owl just splashed down in the water and grabbed a frog that had been calling. I was like, owls fish for frogs? I had no idea. That was super cool. So you call for your females and you die. Big horns, these antlers are not suitable for anything other than fighting with other males. For females, these crazy displays that grouse show, this is a stalk-eyed fly. What advantage could those incredible eyes on the end of stalks have? So all of these things are called secondary sexual traits or characters. These are traits that do not aid in survival, but rather influence mating success. Now, these are very conspicuous traits, and the reason why they evolve, of course, is sexual selection. So Darwin basically had it all figured out, and he figured out sexual selection right from the beginning. Moreover, he wrote a whole book about it. And from that book, here's a quote, "We are here concerned only with that kind of selection which I have called sexual selection. This depends on the advantage which certain individuals have over other individuals of the same sex and species in exclusive relation to reproduction." And what he meant was mating success. So why do males evolve these crazy characters that would seem to be maladaptive, poorly suited for living, basically? Well, here's the reason, and that's that females and males do very different things when it comes to reproduction, and that leads to very different pressures on them for maximizing their success. So let's take a quick look at that. So I'll give some generalizations for females and males, and I really want to emphasize that these are just broad generalizations. There are many, many exceptions. The first thing is about reproductive output. So in essence, the reproductive output of females is limited. They can only produce so many eggs, they can only rear so many kids. Any mothers out there will probably agree to this fact. It's an extremely difficult process. It requires an incredible investment on the mother's part. On the father's part sometimes too, but definitely more so on the mother's part. Now, in principle anyway, reproductive output is much less limited for males. Because as the saying goes, sperm is cheap. So males, a particular fertilization event, doesn't cost them very much, at least in principle. So what that means then is that you maximize your success through two different routes. Females, they want to produce high-quality offspring. The maximum number of kids I can produce is 20. So I want to make sure I have the best 20 kids. Now, it's not going to be a problem to get sperm. Basically, you know, in almost all organisms, females are never limited in their ability to get a mate. So they'll get 20 kids, but they want the best 20. Males, on the other hand, can at least in theory have vastly more kids, because all they can in principle inseminate females, 20 different females. Think of those elephant seals, right? Elephant seals on the beaches in the Antarctic or pretty much anywhere. They have these harems or harems. I always listen to David Attenborough. It's always harem, but I've never thought of harem before. It's always been harem for me. Anyway, there's 200 females, all of which are attended by this one male. So his success can be massive, because he can produce all of the kids by all of the females that he's taking care of. So that then means that you have two different forces acting in relation to competition for mates and in your choice of mates. So competition for mates among females is low. They can all get a mate. There's no problem. It's not that costly for a male to mate, so he'll be willing to produce offspring with pretty much any female. Males, however, often have to compete very intensively for females because they're the limiting resource. So this means that males are expected to fight amongst each other for access to matings where females are not. And the contrary is mate choice. Now, in this situation, females, because they want to maximize their high-quality offspring, they should be picky. They should be choosy. They should pick the males that are going to give them the best 20 offspring, not just a random 20 offspring. Males, on the other hand, since it's not that costly, they don't really care. They're not choosy at all. They'll mate with any female. This is, of course, just a very broad, crude generalization, okay? But males in many species will mate with any female because it's not costly for them. They can produce more kids that way. Okay, that's why sexual selection seems to drive these major traits in males, because they're used for fighting with the other males, and they're used because females are choosy for those traits. Now, I just had to give you this one example of the nature of this effect, not from my own research. This is this crazy bird called the widow bird. It's an African bird. And it's got this ridiculous tail that hangs down. And when it flies, it actually pushes it out and spreads it out in the most aerodynamically inefficient way possible. And I found a video on YouTube to show you for this. I mean, that's just the most ridiculous behavior ever seen. It's certainly not going to increase survival, as far as I can tell. It's conspicuous, and it's extremely costly with respect to energy. And the male just does it back and forth and back and forth and back and forth. Now, the only value of that is to attract a mate. So does it work? So the first thing you can ask is this costly? So you can compare males with short tails and males with long tails and look at how they lose energy measured as the condition of their body through time. So you see that this is days since they established a mating territory and started doing this ridiculous display. And you see that condition declines through time. So they lose weight, they lose energy as they're doing these displays. But, importantly, the males with the long tails lose it much more than the males with the short tails. Now, this energy reserves, this condition is going to be important for avoiding any hawk that happens to attack you. So this tail is costly to males when it comes to natural selection. So why do they have it? Well, obviously, it's because they attract females. And here is a number of active nests. So this is indicative of the number of females that they've mated with for males with long tails and short tails. And you see that there's more, well, there's approximately three times the number of mates for long-tailed males as for short-tailed males. So I've given you an example of natural selection pushing populations apart and then raised this question about the traits that are diverging and the fact that they're probably also important in sexual selection, which might then mess up natural selection. And here's an example of sexual selection. So what I'd like to do now is I'd like to give you this prediction and then look at it in some more detail. So secondary sexual traits should evolve as this compromise between natural and sexual selection. And I'll give a specific example of how that works. Now, I just wanted to give you one last little thing. If you think about the diversity of life, think about flowers. Flowers are not things that have evolved through natural selection. They are things that have evolved through sexual selection. They're for attracting pollinators, which is exclusively important for mating success. You can imagine how all of these things are costly. They produce crazy nectar. They have these incredible colors. They make the plant more visible to potential herbivores. So you have another situation where you think about this incredible diversity of traits that you see out there, all of which are presumably driven by sexual selection, even when natural selection is potentially acting against them. Okay, so what I want to do now is I want to dial this in. I want to go into much greater detail about how this works. And I want to do so for this one system that I work on. So I'll first give you some of the background information that we've confirmed in some of our work, and then highlight a novelty that we've added to it, which is going to get out of this fist fight. Basically, it's going to break this compromise. Okay, so let's go to Trinidad. Let's wander around in beautiful streams in Trinidad. Let's set up our campsites on the edge of rivers and, I don't know, start a fire and catch some river lobster, as they call them, from the streams and cook them up and look at all these incredible critters that you see wandering around the forest floor in Trinidad, leafcutter ants and tarantulas and nice fertile ant snakes, a really nasty snake, actually, and cool frogs and everything else you can imagine. But in reality, most of it is work because we're catching guppies. So we walk around to a whole bunch of different places, take our what amount to butterfly nets, and catch guppies from the different locations, and then try to understand how have the traits of these guppies evolved in response to natural and sexual selection. So here's what you need to know about Trinidadian guppies in general. Here's Trinidad here. Now, this is the island of Trinidad right here. It's off of Venezuela. And along the northern edge of Trinidad, you have a mountain range. Rivers flow to the north and rivers flow to the south. Now, as these rivers flow down out of the mountains, they go over a series of waterfalls. So here's one example here. Let's say you're starting at the top of the mountains and you're walking down the river. You'll walk down through a bunch of pools and over waterfalls, and you won't see any fish at all and no guppies. Then you'll go to a site where all of a sudden you see guppies, but pretty much nothing else, so no predators. Okay? Nothing that's going to select against the traits of guppies from a predation perspective. That is, no predatory fish. Then you go down over waterfalls, and all of a sudden you still have guppies, but now you have the predators. So this means that you have this really nice contrast above the waterfall. There's no predators. But below the waterfall, there's lots of predators. So these predators are going to impose natural selection that we can contrast with the effects of mate choice on guppy traits, guppy color. You know, pet store guppies, right? They're these crazy, beautiful guppies with these fancy tails. So they don't look like that in nature, I'm sorry. As a matter of fact, some of those things, the fanciest ones, are females. Females are not colorful in nature. That's all been done by breeding by aquarists, as they say. But males are extremely colorful in Trinidad. So this is the predators that are going to be the important part of the story. This is Crenocichla. It's a pike cichlid. These are its babies right here. And this is Gobio morus. They're both very nasty predators that eat lots and lots of guppies. And so much is known in particular about what these guys do to guppies. So we're going to be comparing sites with certain types of predators to sites without certain types of predators. Okay, so how does sexual and natural selection work in guppies? They've got these colors, which would seem to be very conspicuous and therefore probably bad for survival. But that's because female guppies love colorful males. So you're looking at here is you take 10 males and you rank them in order of how much orange they have, and then you rank how much the females prefer them, and you see that the males with the most orange are the ones that are the most preferred by females. So that's why high color evolves. High color is probably signaling general quality of the males. So females want a colorful male. That male must have gotten a lot of energy. It must be very vigorous. Therefore, it probably has good genes. So that's the basic idea. But whatever the specific reason that's driving this, females prefer high color. But here's the trade-off. Predators do too. So here's an example of an experiment that was done in the laboratory in big mesocoy, like a big wading pools, if you will. And you start off with a certain number of color spots on the fish, and then you let them evolve. They have very short generation time. So in 10 months, you can have 3 guppy generations. Now, they rapidly evolve high color, and then you give some of the tanks, the guppies in them, you put in the predators, that Crenocichla predator I showed you. And if you look, the color evolves to be much lower. Then the other ones that don't have the predators, they just keep going. So when the predators are present, color evolves to be low. But when predators are absent, female choice drives colors to be high. So that's the prediction from laboratory experiments. Let's go out in nature, and you can collect a whole bunch of guppy populations and array the different populations according to how much predation they're experiencing. And then you can look at the amount of color they have for different color types. And you see, there's a whole bunch of populations for each of these points, that color is decreasing in correspondence with increasing predation. So it seems to work. If you have predators absent, sexual selection drives you to be really colorful. If you have predators present, natural selection drives you to be less colorful. But this is just a correlative test, and so the proof is in the pudding. The litmus test is if you do an experimental manipulation in nature of these things and ask what happens. So here's the normal situation I've been telling you. You have a low predation site with guppies but no predators. Just downstream, you have a high predation site with guppies and predators. There are also many places that don't have predators but also lack guppies. So if we really want to find out what's going on here, we should take guppies from here and introduce them into here and see how they evolve. So they've been experiencing predators. Now let's get rid of the predators and see what happens. So that experiment's been done. You did an introduction from here to there. We've done these experiments as well. But the results I want to show you are the classic ones, showing that the amount of orange color on the fish differs dramatically between natural high predation populations and natural low predation populations. So here versus here. But then you take these fish and introduce them to there, and they very rapidly evolve just as high color as the natural low predation populations. So this is experimental evolution in nature that proves that it's the predators that are keeping color low. See, this is the matrix of possibilities we're talking about. A bunch of populations with predators or not. Sexual selection's driving them, pushing them everywhere to be more colorful, but half of them or some number of them are being held back by predators pushing in the other direction. So in general, then, male guppy color evolves as a compromise between sexual selection favoring more color and natural selection favoring less color. So they're stuck forever. These males in these high predation sites will never be that attractive for females, and females will always be judging males on the very traits that are seemingly bad for their survival. So this is a bad place to be. But maybe there's a way out of it. And that could be through the evolution of private signals. These are signals that you can use to signal between males and females, but that the predators won't see. So how might you do this? Here's one example. This is a thing called an anolis lizard. They're found throughout the Caribbean. And here's the way you see it most of the time, this very brown, drab thing that hangs out on the tree trunk and doesn't seem to have any sort of traits that would be these things that we expect to be sexually selected. But then you just wait a little while, and it sticks out this thing called a dewlap, which has this incredible burst of color, which is then attractive to females and used for displaying to other males to keep them out of your territory. So it's a private signal. You can hide it until the moment that you want to talk to a female, and then you sort of, you know, do the flash and then close it again. So do guppies do something like this as well? Now, it seems that in guppies, there's the potential for at least private visual channels with respect to two different predators. So this is one of the predators. I said that you can catch them and eat them, and they're pretty yummy, but they also catch and eat guppies. Here's the crenocichla I keep referring to, this nasty predatory fish. Now, what's interesting about these things is that they have different visual sensitivities than each other and than guppies. So I'll show you what that looks like. This is the color spectrum raising from UV over here into blue, greens, reds, and infrareds over here. And this is how sensitive these different species are to those colors in their retina. So you can see that guppies basically can see all the way from UV and blue all the way over into the red-orange part of the spectrum. So guppies have a very broad visual spectrum, including UV. Many organisms can see in UV, by the way. We cannot, but many organisms can. But look at the two different predators. So these predatory prawns here, they can see the UV in blue, but they can't see the orange. It's just they don't have a visual pigment that will detect orange. These crenocichla, however, can see orange no problem, but they can't actually see the blue or the UV. So if you're a smart guppy, evolutionarily, you would imagine that if you have a lot of these predators present, you do all your signaling in orange, because it's a private channel. But if there's a lot of these predators around, you do all your signaling in the UV in blue. So let's test that. So this is work that we've done. So we can test that because in different places in Trinidad, you have these different suites of predators. So in these rivers up here, you have lots of these prawns, but you don't have a lot of the other predators. On these southern rivers, you have few prawns, but in these lower parts of the rivers, you have lots of these predators, these crenocichla that can't see in the UV. So up here on the top, let's test this idea that predatory prawns can see blue but not orange. Therefore, guppies should signal more with orange and less with blue. Should signal in the color the predators can't see. I mean, right? But can they do it? Down here, we can test the prediction that predatory fish that see orange but not UV should cause guppies to signal more with UV and less with orange. So I'll give you one study for each of those two things. So let's go up here first, and let's just sample a whole bunch of different places. So this is the great part about going to Trinidad, is you just walk around through beautiful forests and the streams and collect guppies when you come to a place that looks beautiful, a place where you like to take a nap or have lunch or something like that. Oh, let's catch some guppies here. So you can see we've spread out through these watersheds, and we have many more sampling sites now. Some of these sites have the nasty fish predators, and some don't, but they all vary in the proportion or the amount of these prawn predators that are present. So now let's go. You go and collect guppies from all those sites, and you measure their color. And then you take each population, and you plot its average orange versus its average blue. So you see, there's a bunch of populations that have lots of orange and very little blue, and you have a number of other populations that have lots of blue and very little orange. So we would expect, then, that these are the populations here that are with these predatory fishes, maybe, but more importantly, these orange populations here should be the ones that are around a lot of prawns, because the prawns can't see that color. And these differences are pretty dramatic. So here's this population here, lots of orange, and here's this population here, relatively a lot of blue, but very little orange. So here are the results then. These are the same populations, but now we're plotting each of those colors versus the abundance of this prawn predator called Macrobrachium. So as prawn abundance goes up, you see the guppies are less blue, which makes sense because the prawns can see blue. However, if you now look at orange, you see as the amount of prawns go up, so the density of prawns goes up, they actually have more and more orange. So they've shifted their signaling when there's prawns everywhere to go from the blue that the prawns can see to the private channel orange that the prawns can't see. So that's kind of cool, but can they do the opposite now? Can they start signaling in UV and less in orange? So to test that, we went to each of these five different pairs of rivers and sampled a site in STARS in each one that had these nasty predators, and then a bunch of sites that did not have them. So now we're talking about that fish predator, Crenocichla, that can't see ultraviolet or into the short wavelengths of blue. And then we took pictures of the fish normally, but we also took pictures of them where all of the light that's coming to the camera is UV, ultraviolet. So we have a filter on that only allows very short wavelengths through. So this is what a guppy looks like if you only saw it under UV light. And then we tested the prediction that you should see more signaling in this UV for these populations here where the predators can see UV because they've got this private channel. So here are the data for ultraviolet reflectance. The black bars correspond to the sites with lots of the predator, and the white bars to sites in the same river that do not have that predator. And so you see that pretty much in every river, when they're with this predator that can't see UV, they do all their signaling in the UV. So it seems like, although I gave you this case that, you know, males are always stuck and females are always stuck choosing these males, that even though, you know, they might reflect good genes or something, they're going to die and your male offspring will therefore die. Well, it seems like you can break that contrast by finding these private signals that you can talk to the females in, but the predators can't hear. So that's the case I've made now based on some of our work and also based on just classic examples of natural and sexual selection and how they interact in nature. What I want to do now is something that I just made up last night, and that is to try and see how this is going to work in humans. So what I need in humans is I need some trait that you'd expect to evolve to be different in different places and that might be subject to sexual selection as well. And we need to ask, do human populations differ in this trait in response to these different selective conditions, natural selection? And does female choice act against some of those populations adapting to those conditions? So that's what I want to try and do. And to do that, what about humans? I'll use human height. Now, I could use any number of human characteristics, but those properties I just told you about are well represented for humans, and there's research on all of them. And actually, we've done a bit on it as well. So human height is extremely variable. So I'll show you the tallest person in the world and the shortest person in the world. They brought them together for, obviously, a photo op. This is my favorite one right here. And there was a picture, actually, of him standing, like the tall guy standing here, and the little guy was standing on a table in front of him. And before I blew up the picture, I thought it was like one of those baby Bjorns. I thought he was, you know, one of those kid carriers that he had on his chest. So this guy, Sultan Kosin, is only 74 centimeters high, where he, Ping Ping, is 246 centimeters. Now, this is extremely divergent, but the point goes to show you that you can have large variation in human height. So what is natural selection doing to this? So natural selection will be the first part, then sexual selection, then some discussion of the balance between them, and then just for fun, actually this was in the last hour, I said, could there be private signals with respect to these things? Okay, so one of the most common trends for adaptation of height or size in any organism is a relationship between temperature and size. So as temperatures get colder, usually at higher latitudes and elevations, humans should be larger, and all organisms should be larger. This is called Bergman's rule. Now, there's a number of possibilities for why this might be, but here's the one that's most commonly invoked, and that is surface-to-volume ratio. So the heat that you produce and that you retain is a function of your volume, the mass that you have, if you will. But the rate at which you lose it to the environment is a function of your surface area. So if you have more surface area, you're going to lose more heat. So if you want to lose a lot of heat, you should have a high surface to volume ratio. But if you want to lose little heat, you should have a low surface to volume ratio. So here's a box here where you have one unit along each axis. The volume is 1, the surface area is 6 units, and the surface to volume ratio is 6:1. But now let's just double the linear dimension, so double the height, let's say. And now your volume becomes 8, your surface area becomes 24, and your surface to volume ratio is only 3. So here, you're protecting your large volume because you only have a small surface area relative to it. But if you're small, you've got a lot of surface area to the volume you have, you're going to lose heat quickly. So if you're in cold environments, then you should be big, but if you're in hot environments, you should be small. So we can test that for humans. You can go out, and humans are, in some ways, the best study subject, and in other ways, the worst study subject. But here's the cool part about humans, is that they are spread in natural, pre-industrial populations. This is where most of the data come from. All the way from the very north to the very south and through the very hot tropics in the middle, as well as high elevation and low elevation. Humans exist across a huge range of temperatures as indigenous populations. So you can go and sample from these populations and ask how tall are they? Are humans taller, larger in the colder regions? Are they taller in higher elevations? Things like that. So a lot of people have done this, but we happen to have done it as well, so I'll show you our data. So we collected data from 108 different human populations and just plotted height and mass versus latitude. And here are the results. You see, here's height along here and mass along here. These are males and these are females, and each dot is a different indigenous human population. And you see that as you go further away from the tropics, you have larger sizes. Now, there's a lot of variation within a given latitude, but part of which is a function of elevation. So there's other things going on. But nonetheless, you see this trend for adaptive divergence in human height among populations in response to an environmental pressure being temperature. So that means that if you're in the tropics, you want to be small, relatively, because you can get rid of excess heat. But if you're in the Arctic or Antarctic, I suppose there's no humans in the Antarctic, unfortunately, at least not on a long-term basis. Although now, of course, there's a research station at the South Pole. But if you want to go visit there, you got to stay 6 months because there's no planes going in or out. So in the Arctic, up here, you want to be big, and in hot environments in the tropics, you want to be small. Okay, that's fine. So just like salmon, humans are diverging in response to some environmental pressure. But what about sexual selection? Now, there's been a ton of work on who males and females prefer in humans. So we'll ask about that in relation to height. So here we're going to look at data for the height of males and how they're ranked by females, and the height of females and how they're ranked by males. So this is how females are choosing males, and this is how males are choosing females. Like, well, I say I'm 6'1", I should be doing pretty well. So let's see what happens here. Females prefer large males in general. So there's this trend. These are where most of the data points here along here. As you get bigger, you have a higher rank. So you have this tendency that there's positive selection by females on male height. Probably part of the reason why males are larger than females. What about females? So what do males think about females? What do you think? Males don't care. So you have this tendency, at least for males, to be in these populations and in many populations, they're pushing, females are pushing males to be bigger. Not so much so males pushing on females. Women generally prefer larger men as mates. Men are not picky. Okay, so that's fine and everything. But that would suggest then that if in those tropical populations you still had females selecting larger males, that means that natural and sexual selection are pushing against each other, which would be an interesting phenomenon. So is that true? So you might want to test that then by asking whether females prefer larger males, even in hot areas, and especially where people are short. So the shortest people in the world, except for hobbits from Middle Earth or something like that, are pygmies, African pygmies, which are found in very hot environments. Here's a, you know, one of the early colonial administrators showing off his adult pygmy friends. And the question is now, what do pygmies prefer? Pygmy females. Do they still prefer larger males? Because they're pretty darn small. So let's test that by, well, I didn't test this. But a group of researchers did. They went and in this pygmy population, as well as in a population nearby, so same temperature, but a bit bigger, and asked about their preferences as well. So here are the average heights of male and female pygmies and male and female non-pygmies. I could have given you the names of the actual groups, but I simplified it this way. Where you can see that the pygmies are indeed smaller, but even the non-pygmies from the same area are also relatively small. So they looked at mate choice by males. So this is females choosing males and males choosing females. And they asked, what do they prefer? So in this case, this is, they're using as a metric multiple marriages. So males that have more marriages, they're conceiving to be males that are preferred by females. They had a bunch of other metrics in this study, and they all showed similar results. So what about the males now? In pygmies, right? I mean, we're talking about very small people, right? Well, females like taller males. And they do so also in the non-pygmies that are in the same hot environment. So here you have populations that have evolved to be small, in principle from natural selection should be small, and yet females still prefer large males. What about female height? How do males select on females? Well, they don't really care that much. But if anything, they actually seem to prefer a bit smaller females, but there's no significance to any of these trends. So taller men do have higher mating success. Taller women do not have higher mating success. So it seems to me that here you have in humans the same natural versus sexual selection conflict that you have in guppies and many other organisms. So I was just speculating on this right before coming here as to whether or not humans could therefore use private signals. Now, an important thing here is that height is not being selected, at least not now, by predators, right? So we're not talking about predators. Instead, we're talking about the environment. So I'm going to very broaden my discussion of private to meaning something that will shield you from natural selection, temperature, and yet allow you to attract a mate. So I thought of some possibilities. One is you can just sort of protect yourself from the environment so you get nice clothes. So Inuit people are actually not that large, and they are covering themselves in wonderful caribou skin or seal skin, which is keeping them warm. So this is why humans, of course, can exist all the way from the Arctic regions all the way down to the tropics, and all even though they do adapt to some extent in size, they are really shielding themselves from the elements. So basically that means that, in principle anyway, females can still choose larger males because it won't make that much of a difference. However, I was thinking about this, and once you're in really hot tropical environments, you really can't get rid of your excess heat through clothing. So I'm not sure that this would really work in the tropics, right? You can't, if you're big in the tropics, you're just big. You're gonna have this heating problem. Well, the other possibility, of course, is that you sort of signal in something else, maybe even a better currency of how good you are, and that is, you know, money. So you collect lots of money, and presumably females will like you. But I did realize, actually, when thinking about this, that actually you might actually be subject to predation if you get too much wealth, as Tolkien has taught us. Another thing that humans can do is that instead of changing their height, they can show off in other ways. So now, of course, the general expectation is that females show off more than males. But in many societies, males also show off like crazy as well. And that's increasingly so in our societies as well. Now, the final one I have to tell you about, and the reason I'm telling you about it is it really did just come out 2 days ago. Okay? Now, the question here is that there are other things about males that perhaps females might be making choices on. And so, of course, everybody's thinking, yeah, right, penis size, right? But here's the problem. So people have studied this, really, literally. This is serious science here. They've gone out and measured male penises, and they've seen and asked females about their choices. But apparently they'd never properly separated actual body size from penis size. So a study just came out 3 days ago, and that's why I'm showing you, that did this by creating digital men that varied in their height, in their shoulder to hip ratio, and in their penis size. It's actually kind of funny. There's another picture like this that's on the web, except it has little white covers over the penises, like the fig leaves, you know, from the old drawings. But it's really funny because they scale according to the size of the penis that they're hiding. So in this study, they showed that females, if you standardize for everything else, females prefer males with larger penises. Now, I hope that that's not going to be something that's going to heavily influence heat loss, and so maybe that's a private signal in humans as well. They also showed that basically selection for penis height or penis size, independent of body size, is about the same as selection for body size independent of penis size. So on that rather phallic closing note, I'll give you some conclusions. The first is that I've shown the rather obvious phenomenon that natural selection causes populations to become different if they're in different environments. But sexual selection sometimes acts in opposition to that natural selection. It basically prevents populations from diverging to the extent that they would if natural selection was the only cause. I think humans may be subject to the same constraints, although it's not usually thought of in this manner. So there's not a lot of papers that are written specifically on that. Private signals can evolve to escape this fistfight between natural and sexual selection. Certainly true in a number of non-human organisms, and perhaps it's also true of humans, although I actually have no idea whatsoever. Thank you. So first interesting point about giraffes is they have the same number of vertebrae in their neck as we do. So they have not got more vertebrae. Instead, their vertebrae are like that. The other thing that's really interesting about giraffes is they fight with their necks. There's this really cool new Africa video by BBC that shows these giraffes just swinging their necks like this and just whacking each other. It's incredible. And the other thing I want to mention about giraffes is the thing that I find really fascinating about them, and the same thing with hippos and elephants too, is that if they didn't exist, we would not think they were possible. They're so far from everything else that we would say, where are the intermediate stages? And yet we know that they evolved through a sequence in the fossil record from relatively small to relatively large. So I think it's a really interesting problem in what is possible, because if something doesn't exist, we say, oh, well, that's not possible. But is it impossible, or has evolution just not achieved it yet? I don't know. So guppies can do that to some extent. They can sort of close down their colors. They can be bright or less or more. The part that we measured, though, was apart from that. So we were able to standardize the conditions for everybody, and they showed those particular differences. So both of those things occur. This is genetic divergence in the overall amount of color you have, but individuals can still make choices to turn on or off colors to some extent when they're around a female or when a predator comes by, for example. Yeah. Predators basically, well, they might see them, of course. They might change their color quickly because they see the predator over there. As a matter of fact, if you look in these streams, you see a school of guppies here and the predator is just right over there. So they know they're around. In addition, predators have smells, essentially. And so if you just dip water that a predator has been swimming in and drip it into a guppy tank, then the guppies will respond. So they can sense that there's a predator present. The natural range of guppies is Venezuela and Trinidad and a little bit south of Venezuela. But they've been introduced all over the world because they're used for mosquito control, just like mosquito fish. So they're all over the world now. And you can see similar patterns in populations in other places in the world as well. In general, the first premise is correct, that basically there's the huge fishing on cod in the 70s and 80s caused the population to decline, of course, so we're not fishing them, but it also caused them to evolve to be much smaller, like 30% smaller. Since that time, the cod have not recovered, and they also have not evolved to be bigger. So one of the arguments why they're not recovering is that they're small, and small females have much lower reproductive output than large females. So the argument is that they might have to evolve to be bigger before the population is going to recover. Now, no one knows for sure, but one would imagine that they were big for a reason in the first place that was presumably favored by selection. So now that we've removed the fishing, one would hope that with enough time, I don't know, probably a bit longer than the fishing pressure because it's much more direct, they will evolve back to be large again. I don't know the time frame. I know organisms from some of our other work, they can evolve very quickly, like in decades, but only if the selection acting on them is strong. So maybe fishing selection acting, causing them to be small, was very strong, so they evolved very quickly. But now once that fishing pressure is gone, the natural selection pushing them back could be much weaker, and so it could take much longer.
These tall European explorers going and visiting these villages with pygmies, but you never answered the question about what was up with the pygmy women and the tall European explorers.
Well, as far as I know, you didn't all of a sudden see intermediate size and intermediate colored people in that area. It's quite possible, though.
And with that inappropriate question, capture forever for posterity, we'll close Mini Science 2013 on a high note. Thank you very much, Andrew. Great talk.